You will hear a telephone conversation about booking a venue for a private event. You have 30 seconds to look at questions 1 to 10.
This is George and Dragon. How may I help?
Hi. I'm calling to inquire about your upstairs venue. I'm interested in booking it for a private event, and I was wondering if I could ask a few questions.
Yes, of course. Just give me a second, please. So, before we start, could I please get a name and phone number?
Yes. My name is Clara Carlton.
Carly, could you spell that for me, please?
Sure. It's C-A-R-L-E-T-O-N.
And the phone number?
Well, I'm going to give you my work number as I'm booking the venue for a work event.
Right.
So it's 020-8322-1479.
Great. So what would you like to know?
Well, I saw on your website that the price can be from £20 per hour, so I would like to get an exact quote if possible.
Well, the price depends on the type of event, the date, and the number of people, and whether we will be providing food as well.
Oh, it's for a retirement party for one of my colleagues.
Okay, and for which date is that?
Well, we were thinking next Tuesday, the 31st of May.
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry, but the venue's already booked that day. We're free on Monday and Wednesday, if that would suit you.
Well, Wednesday's no good, because the gentleman who's retiring will be gone by then. But Monday works just as fine.
Great. You'll get a cheaper rate for Monday too.
Excellent.
And how many people will there be?
Well, at the moment it's supposed to be 16, but it might go up to 17. We're waiting for one of our co-workers to confirm whether they'll be available that night or not.
The boardroom in the venue only has space for 15 people, I'm afraid. We've got enough standing room for about 15 extra people. Is that all right?
Oh, I'm sure it will be fine. We won't be sitting down much anyway. Would it be possible to provide two extra chairs just in case, though?
Yes, of course.
Great.
And finally, will you be needing us to provide food as well?
Well, we'll be bringing the cake, but I imagine that yes, we will be ordering some food as well. What are your options for nibbles?
Well, we've got quite a vast selection depending on which type of menu you're interested in. We've got meat-based tapas, as well as some vegetarian and vegan options, and we've also got some sharers.
Well, as far as I know, none of us are vegans, so I don't think we'll be needing that. Some meat-based and vegetarian options would be great, though.
Would you like me to talk you through them, or...?
Well, you do have the menu online, right?
Yeah, you can find it on our website. The only thing is that a couple of options have been removed and replaced with new ones, and we haven't had the chance to update it online yet.
Okay, let me just pull it up on my screen. Just a second. All right.
So, in the meat-based food section, the dishes that have been discontinued are the mini fajitas and the pulled pork bruschetta.
Oh, that's a shame. The pulled pork bruschetta looked really nice.
Yeah, but we've replaced them with two new, really popular dishes. We've got a trio of sliders, which is three mini burgers, made one each with chicken, beef, and pulled pork. And we've also got ham and cheese croquettes.
Oh, that sounds nice. So I'll have seven of the mini burgers then. I see you've also got vegetarian croquettes. Are they still in the menu?
Yeah, we've got the vegetable croquette and the potato croquette.
And how many croquettes are there in each dish?
The vegetable one is 5, the potato one is 4.
Okay, so I'll have 2 of the vegetable croquettes, and I'll also have 2 of the ham and cheese ones, please.
Great. Anything else?
Well, I don't know. It all looks so nice. What would you recommend?
Well, what I would recommend is the simmered squid. It's slow cooked in wine and served with potatoes. I'd also recommend the hummus platters. Our chef actually makes his own hummus, and it's one of our most popular sharers. And, of course, all of our salads, especially the Caesar salad. We're famous for them.
Right. So I'll go for 5 hummus platters. Or should I get 6? No. You know what? 5 is just fine. I won't be having any of the squid. It sounds lovely, but I'm just not sure how popular it would be with my colleagues.
Yeah, fair enough.
And finally, one Caesar salad and one vegetarian, the goat's cheese one.
Great. And just for the final question, for how many hours would you be booking the venue?
Well, we'd be arriving straight after work, so somewhere around 7 p.m. And I'd expect we'd need it until at least 9 p.m, maybe even 10 p.m, so...
So 3 hours?
Well, probably. But let's make it 4, just in case.
Right. Great. So just give me a minute and I'll get back to you with a quote, all right?
Yes, of course.
Hi. So I spoke to my manager and the total with the food and a drink starter for 17 people would come up to £318.95.
Okay.
But he'd be happy to offer you a 5% discount, which would bring the total down to just £303. And that includes a pint of any beer, a glass of wine or fizzy drink for each person.
Okay, that sounds reasonable enough. Let's go for it.
Right, so I would just need a deposit of... You will hear a talk about the history of a poetry award. You have 30 seconds to look at questions 11 to 15.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this year's award ceremony for the Antonia Watson Memorial Poetry Award. As with previous years, the competition has been particularly fierce and we received numerous excellent entries, so it's an incredible achievement for our three finalists who are sitting here amongst you, and we should congratulate them all. However, as with every competition, there can unfortunately only be one winner, and we will be announcing them shortly. Before we do, though, a few words about the award itself. As most of you know, the Antonia Watson Memorial Poetry Award has been presented annually since 2010 and was presented biannually for two more competitions prior, once in 2008 and once in 2006. It is entirely funded by Antonia Watson's very generous parents, who offer £1,500 to the author of the best poem on a topic announced at each previous award ceremony, as well as £500 to the first runner-up and £250 to the second, bringing the total up to £2,250. Now, a few words on Antonia Watson herself, without whom none of us would be standing here today. I briefly knew Antonia while at university, where we were flatmates for a year, and I'm afraid that any speech I give will not be able to do her justice, as she was the kindest, sweetest person I've ever met. Thankfully, this part of my speech was written with the assistance of one of her siblings, Thomas Watson, who was not only her brother, but also her best friend. Antonia was born in Slayford, Lincolnshire, in December 1986. From a very young age, she displayed an inquisitive and creative nature, matched in volume only by the gentle kindness of her spirit. She wrote her first poem, named Love Barks, about the death of her dog at the age of 10. This was also her first poem to be published at her school's newspaper, just 2 months after another of her poems, Be Kind, won the 1996 Triad Children's Writing Competition and was published in the competition's anthology. While her early forays into poetry were crowned with impressive success, Antonia unfortunately ceased to write for a few years following the death of her very dear grandfather, Peter William Watson, in 1999.
You now have 30 seconds to look at questions 16 to 18.
While her early forays into poetry were crowned with impressive success, Antonia unfortunately ceased to write for a few years following the death of her very dear grandfather, Peter William Watson, in 1999. Despite her writer's block, however, her artistic nature didn't lie dormant during the next 4 years. She had an active role in various theatre plays, and she also ventured into painting. A few of the plays are available on the internet, and you can find several of her self-portraits on our website, and you can see for yourself how impressive they are. But poetry, of course, remained her passion even then, which is why in 2003 she resumed writing, and her next poem, The War on Both Sides, was published in her college's journal. At the age of 18, Antonia moved to Sheffield to study English literature at the University of Sheffield. This is where she and I met, spending a whole year in adjacent rooms in a flat in central Sheffield. This is also where I met her good-natured, generous parents, Mr. and Mrs. Watson, who came to visit her regularly and always treated me like a daughter as well. Antonia and I grew very close during that period, and while we ran in different circles, we always found time for each other every week. Antonia self-published one collection of poems in August 2005. It was named Burning Stars, after the poem on page 16, which is also the date of her birthday. It was an immediate success amongst her peers at the University of Sheffield, and it was so cherished by her English literature classmates specifically that it had attracted the attention of one of her lecturers, who put her in touch with a literary agent. She had been due to begin working on her second collection right before her tragic passing in a car accident just 5 days before her 19th birthday in December 2005.
You now have 30 seconds to look at questions 19 to 20.
Antonia was always interested in societal shifts and how they affect humanity as well as the environment, and this award was designed to reflect her faith that regardless of what we do, we are all inherently good. With this in mind, all of the topics this competition has dealt with have been about the potential and the positive side of humanity, such as this year's Young Love theme or last year's Inner Power theme. We've had poems about personal strength, about immigration, about gender equality and peaceful protest. And hopefully in 12 months, the poems we'll be awarding will be just as inspiring with the topic of poverty. I know Antonia would be really proud of what her parents and what all of you together have achieved. So, finally, let's get on with the actual award. As I said before, it's been a fierce competition this year, and with more than 5,000 entries, it was quite the task for our three judges to cut them down to just three. But our three finalists definitely deserve to be here, and without further ado, I would like to...
Section 3. You will hear a conversation between a tutor and two students who are preparing for an English literature test. First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 24. Listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 24.
Hello, Lorna. Ian. Glad you could make it. You're the only two who put your names down for this literature tutorial, so let's get started, shall we? I want to run over some aspects of the novel The Secret Garden with you before the test next week. Be sure to take some notes and ask questions if you need to.
Hey, Lorna, have you got a spare pen?
Sure, here you are.
Okay. So, the story follows two key characters. You should refer to them as protagonists, who go by the names of Mary Lennox and Colin Craven. The story is set shortly after the turn of the 20th century, and the narrative tracks the development of the protagonists as they learn to overcome their own personal troubles together.
That's quite a common storyline, isn't it?
Yes, you're right, Lorna. So what can you tell me about the character of Mary?
Well, in the beginning, she is an angry, rude child who is orphaned after a cholera outbreak and forced to leave India and move to the United Kingdom to her uncle's house in Yorkshire.
That's right. And there she meets Colin, who spends his days in an isolated room, believing himself to be permanently crippled, with no hope of ever gaining the ability to walk. The two strike up a friendship, and gradually learn, by encouraging each other, that they can both become healthy, happy, and fulfilled in life.
Will we need to remember a lot of these details for the exam?
Just the basic outline. Examiners don't want to read a plot summary. They know what the book is about. Focus on narrative techniques instead, such as point of view.
What's that mean?
It's all about how we see the story. This story, for example, is written from the perspective of what is called an omniscient narrator. Omniscient means all-knowing. So as readers, we get to see how all the characters feel about things, what they like and don't like, and what their motivations are in the story.
Before you hear the rest of the conversation, you have some time to look at questions 25 to 30. Now listen and answer questions 25 to 30.
Won't it be hard to write a technical analysis? After all, it's a kid's book.
Well, it was initially pitched at adults, you know. But over the years, it has become seen as a more youth-orientated work. And you're right in a sense. The simple vocabulary and absence of foreshadowing make the story very easy to follow and ideally suited for children. But that doesn't mean there isn't much to analyse. Look at the symbolism, for instance.
Symbols are things, right? Material things, like objects that stand for abstract ideas.
Absolutely, yes. And the author uses many of them. There's the robin redbreast, for example, which symbolises the wise and gentle nature that Mary will soon adopt. Note that the robin is described as not at all like the birds in India. Roses are used as well, as a personal symbol for Mistress Craven. You'll see they're always mentioned alongside her name, and Mistress Craven's portrait can also be interpreted as a symbol of her spirit.
Are symbols just another name for motifs?
No, motifs are a bit different. They don't have as direct a connection with something the way that a symbol does. Motifs are simply recurring elements of the story that support the mood.
Are there any in this novel?
Yes, two very important ones. The Garden of Eden is a motif. It comes up a few times in connection with the garden of the story. And then you've got the role that secrets play in the story. In the beginning, everything is steeped in secrecy, and slowly the characters share their secrets, and in the process move from darkness to lightness, metaphorically. But also, in the case of Colin, quite literally. His room in the beginning has the curtains drawn, and he appears at the end in the brightness of the garden.
Anything else we need to know about?
Yes. Nearly all novels explore universal concepts that everyone has experienced. Things like love, family, loneliness, friendship. These are called themes. The Secret Garden has a few themes that all centre on the idea of connections. The novel explores, for example, the way that health can determine and be determined by our outlook on life. As Colin's health improves, so too do his perceptions of his strength and possibility. The author also examines the link between our environment and our physical and emotional prosperity. The dark, cramped rooms of the manor house stifle the development of our protagonists. The garden and natural environments allow them to blossom, just as the flowers do. Finally, this book looks at connections between individuals, namely Mary and Colin. This necessity of human companionship is the novel's most significant theme, because none of their development as individuals would have occurred without their knowing each other. Well, that about sums it up, I think.
That's a great help. Thanks.
Yes, thanks very much.
That is the end of section three. You now have half a minute to check your answers. Now turn to section four. Section four. You will hear a talk on the topic of time perspectives. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Today, I'm going to be talking about time. Specifically, I'll be looking at how people think about time and how these time perspectives structure our lives. According to social psychologists, there are six ways of thinking about time, which are called personal time zones. The first two are based in the past. Past positive thinkers spend most of their time in a state of nostalgia, fondly remembering moments such as birthdays, marriages, and important achievements in their life. These are the kinds of people who keep family records, books, and photo albums. People living in the past negative time zone are also absorbed by earlier times. But they focus on all the bad things, regrets, failures, poor decisions. They spend a lot of time thinking about how life could have been. Then, we have people who live in the present. Present hedonists are driven by pleasure and immediate sensation. Their life motto is to have a good time and avoid pain. Present fatalists live in the moment too, but they believe this moment is the product of circumstances entirely beyond their control. It's their fate, whether it's poverty, religion, or society itself. Something stops these people from believing they can play a role in changing their outcomes in life. Life simply is, and that's that. Looking at the future time zone, we can see that people classified as future active are the planners and go-getters. They work rather than play and resist temptation. Decisions are made based on potential consequences, not on the experience itself. A second future-orientated perspective, future fatalistic, is driven by the certainty of life after death and some kind of a judgment day when they will be assessed on how virtuously they have lived and what success they have had in their lives. Okay, let's move on. You might ask, how do these time zones affect our lives? Well, let's start at the beginning. Everyone is brought into this world as a present hedonist. No exceptions. Our initial needs and demands, to be warm, secure, fed, and watered, all stem from the present moment. But things change when we enter formal education. We're taught to stop existing in the moment and to begin thinking about future outcomes. But did you know that every 9 seconds, a child in the USA drops out of school? For boys, the rate is much higher than for girls. We could easily say, ah, well, boys just aren't as bright as girls. But the evidence doesn't support this. A recent study states that boys in America, by the age of 21, have spent 10,000 hours playing video games. The research suggests that they'll never fit in the traditional classroom, because these boys require a situation where they have the ability to manage their own learning environment. Now, let's look at the way we do prevention education. All prevention education is aimed at a future time zone. We say, Don't smoke or you'll get cancer. Get good grades or you won't get a good job. But with present-orientated kids, that just doesn't work. Although they understand the potentially negative consequences of their actions, they persist with the behavior because they're not living for the future. They're in the moment right now. We can't use logic, and it's no use reminding them of potential fallout from their decisions or previous errors of judgment. We've got to get in their minds just as they're about to make a choice. Time perspectives make a big difference in how we value and use our time. When Americans are asked how busy they are, the vast majority report being busier than ever before. They admit to sacrificing their relationships, personal time, and a good night's sleep for their success. 20 years ago, 60% of Americans had sit-down dinners with their families, and now, only 20% do. But when they're asked what they would do with an 8-day week, they say, oh, that'd be great. They would spend that time laboring away to achieve more. They're constantly trying to get ahead, to get toward a future point of happiness. So, it's really important to be aware of how other people think about time. We tend to think, oh, that person's really irresponsible, or that guy's power hungry. But often, what we're looking at is not fundamental differences of personality, but really just different ways of thinking about time. Seeing these conflicts as differences in time perspective, rather than distinctions of character, can facilitate more effective cooperation between people and get the most out of each person's individual strengths.
That is the end of section 4. You now have half a minute to check your answers. That is the end of the listening test. You now have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to the listening answer sheet. Section 4. You will hear a talk on the topic of time perspectives. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Listen carefully and answer questions 31 to 40.
Today, I'm going to be talking about time. Specifically, I'll be looking at how people think about time and how these time perspectives structure our lives. According to social psychologists, there are 6 ways of thinking about time, which are called personal time zones. The first 2 are based in the past. Past positive thinkers spend most of their time in a state of nostalgia, fondly remembering moments such as birthdays, marriages, and important achievements in their life. These are the kinds of people who keep family records, books, and photo albums. People living in the past negative time zone are also absorbed by earlier times. But they focus on all the bad things, regrets, failures, poor decisions. They spend a lot of time thinking about how life could have been. Then, we have people who live in the present. Present hedonists are driven by pleasure and immediate sensation. Their life motto is to have a good time and avoid pain. Present fatalists live in the moment too, but they believe this moment is the product of circumstances entirely beyond their control. It's their fate, whether it's poverty, religion, or society itself. Something stops these people from believing they can play a role in changing their outcomes in life. Life simply is, and that's that. Looking at the future time zone, we can see that people classified as future active are the planners and go-getters. They work rather than play and resist temptation. Decisions are made based on potential consequences, not on the experience itself. A second future-orientated perspective, future fatalistic, is driven by the certainty of life after death and some kind of a judgment day when they will be assessed on how virtuously they have lived and what success they have had in their lives. Okay, let's move on. You might ask, how do these time zones affect our lives? Well, let's start at the beginning. Everyone is brought into this world as a present hedonist. No exceptions. Our initial needs and demands, to be warm, secure, fed, and watered, all stem from the present moment. But things change when we enter formal education. We're taught to stop existing in the moment and to begin thinking about future outcomes. But did you know that every 9 seconds, a child in the USA drops out of school? For boys, the rate is much higher than for girls. We could easily say, ah, well, boys just aren't as bright as girls. But the evidence doesn't support this. A recent study states that boys in America, by the age of 21, have spent 10,000 hours playing video games. The research suggests that they'll never fit in the traditional classroom, because these boys require a situation where they have the ability to manage their own learning environment. Now, let's look at the way we do prevention education. All prevention education is aimed at a future time zone. We say, don't smoke or you'll get cancer. Get good grades or you won't get a good job. But with present-oriented kids, that just doesn't work. Although they understand the potentially negative consequences of their actions, they persist with the behavior because they're not living for the future. They're in the moment right now. We can't use logic, and it's no use reminding them of potential fallout from their decisions or previous errors of judgment. We've got to get in their minds just as they're about to make a choice. Time perspectives make a big difference in how we value and use our time. When Americans are asked how busy they are, the vast majority report being busier than ever before. They admit to sacrificing their relationships, personal time, and a good night's sleep for their success. 20 years ago, 60% of Americans had sit-down dinners with their families, and now only 20% do. But when they're asked what they would do with an 8-day week, they say, oh, that'd be great. They would spend that time laboring away to achieve more. They're constantly trying to get ahead, to get toward a future point of happiness. So it's really important to be aware of how other people think about time. We tend to think, oh, that person's really irresponsible, or that guy's power hungry. But often, what we're looking at is not fundamental differences of personality, but really just different ways of thinking about time. Seeing these conflicts as differences in time perspective, rather than distinctions of character, can facilitate more effective cooperation between people and get the most out of each person's individual strengths.
That is the end of section 4. You now have half a minute to check your answers. That is the end of the listening test. You now have 10 minutes to transfer your answers to the listening answer sheet.